Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What keeps Mormon missionaries going and going and going? Craig Harleen left for his two-year stint in Belgium in the 1970s with a head full of newly learned Dutch and a heart full of optimism. As a boy, he had soaked up the inspiring stories returning missionaries told about baptizing newly converted souls in faraway places. He had fully expected to do so himself dozens of times on his own mission and was stunned to discover how hard it was to fulfill this seemingly simple goal. But as he'll tell us, he also discovered the experience could have great personal and spiritual value to him, even if he couldn't help the LDS Church gain a strong foothold in then deeply Catholic Belgium. Craig Harleen teaches European history at Brigham Young University. His new memoir is called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. Craig, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me here, Chris.
I want to be clear from the outset, you are still a practicing member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This is not some tell-all indictment of Mormonism or the missionary tradition. You just think people should be free to share realistic accounts of what missionary work is like.
Right. I think that's been a trend in religious writing generally, maybe in the last 15 years, but certainly within Mormonism too, with the expansion of the internet and so on. It's almost required to be honest about your experiences nowadays.
Not that people were necessarily dishonest, but can you talk about what informed your expectations growing up of what your mission would be like?
Right. It's not dishonesty. It's more just telling part of the story. And I think when I grew up, I heard certain stories, and my personality processed them in a certain way. I think other people could have processed them differently, so I'm certainly not blaming other people for my own particular perceptions. But I processed them in a way that made it seem like there was this one true narrative that happened to every missionary as long as you tried your best. And when it didn't happen to me, then it was just I had to fall back on I didn't know what. I didn't have anything to fall back on. And it ended up, you know, you have to kind of dig inside and fall back on yourself and whatever you feel like your relationship is with God. So
I have to imagine some people are ambivalent about doing missionary work, even if they feel it's something they need to do. But it sounds like there was no doubt in your mind that you wanted to do this.
Oh, yeah. From the time if you're raised Mormon, from the time you're, especially if you're a little boy, it's just kind of something that you expect you're going to do. And you see other people do it, you see your brothers do it, friends. And, you know, they come back with such terrific stories and they seem so happy. And sure, you want to do something like that, too. They seem to have these great experiences. They do these miracles. They speak in new languages. And so that was all really attractive to me, no doubt.
So what is the primary goal of Mormon missionaries? What specifically do you go to do?
Well, it's probably changed over time, but when I was there, it was certainly to try to convert people. And I think nowadays there's more of a sense of information with some missionaries. It kind of depends on the missionary and it depends on their mission president. There's a president in every mission around the world. So I think it's to build goodwill and so on. But back in the 70s, I think it was still pretty much to make converts. And so that's if you didn't do that, then you felt like you were coming up short, I think. At least I did.
Well, I love this, that you had it in your head that you would be instrumental in 84 conversions. And can you talk about what made that number stick in your head?
Well, I think that was, again, a part of my own particular imagination. But one day just before leaving, I kind of felt like I had this vision that there would be 84 converts, you know, waiting to hear this message from me. And I thought, I knew that was an extraordinary number, especially in a place like Europe, because it was notorious for not producing very many converts at all. But I thought, you know, if you believe enough, if you have enough faith, it's kind of an old Christian idea. If you have enough faith, you can do anything.
Mm-hmm. And there's this idea, too, that if your faith is very precious to you, you want to share it with other people, and you can't imagine that they would hear it with anything other than gratitude. But it turns out that it's not always the case.
Exactly. No, you feel like it's brought you some happiness, and therefore you feel like, how can they not possibly see that? And even though the entire country was Catholic, I just couldn't imagine that they were not waiting on pins and needles for me to come and tell them this.
What did you know about Catholicism before you lived in Belgium?
Not very much at all. I had some friends at school. I grew up in California, and I had some friends at school who were Catholic, and I knew they went to something called catechism. And there was a Newman Center around the corner from my church building, and they all looked pretty much like the people going in and out of my church building, but somehow I had this image of them that if you dug a little deeper, it just would not be very pleasant.
Hmm. So how are missionaries assigned, Mormon missionaries assigned to different outposts around the world? Tell us a little bit about that process.
Right. You submit an application or your papers, as it's called, some months before you want to go, and you send them to Salt Lake City, the church headquarters, and these assignments are made. It's not always exactly clear how this works, but clearly there's a committee that does the assigning, and you don't really know where you're going to go. So I was delighted that I was going to Europe. I'd wanted to go there, but there's this kind of idea, too, that if you want to go somewhere, especially if it's somewhere exotic like that, that you won't go there. And so you kind of have to wish to make yourself want to go to someplace like Montana. Then you might have a chance to go to Europe. But I couldn't quite root out that desire, and I still went to Europe, so I felt really lucky.
Is that the worst, like a domestic posting is such a disappointment?
You know what? The domestic missions probably turn out to be a lot happier for people because at least they're operating in an environment that's fairly familiar to them. I mean, if you're from California and you go on a mission to the South or to the Northeast, it's a new culture too, and a slightly new language as well, and you're dealing with a new context that you have to learn. But at least you're within a culture that's somewhat familiar. And if you go to Europe, you feel like it's going to be familiar because it looks familiar in many ways, but it's really quite a bit different. And then you have to deal with the whole problem of a completely new language.
You know, thinking about this tradition of sending the majority of young people of a certain age to other parts of the country, other parts of the world, have very little contact with their families. It occurs to me that what you're really doing is creating a church full of people that understand things outside their previous experience, which is even outside of the ability to convert or not convert. That's a pretty noble goal.
That's definitely one of the byproducts. And I suppose how much you get out of that depends on you too. Because, I mean, we all know people who have traveled around the world and they've never left their little bubble, you know, wherever that happens to be, you know, Dallas or Provo or whatever. But then there are other people who probably haven't left home and have a very wide-ranging sort of mind and open-heartedness. But in general, I'd say that traveling and having to see new situations really does help you to do that and should produce goodwill.
Being a California-raised Mormon, I mean, did you have a different sense of yourself and your faith and your connection to it than you think you might have had you grown up in Salt Lake City?
Perhaps, yeah, because in California, I was definitely in the minority, and in Salt Lake City, I wouldn't have been really, not at all, in fact, but in California, I felt, yeah, a certain sense of martyrdom, I suppose, you know, I mean, there were kids who kind of, you know, said things to you that weren't really pleasant just because of your faith. And, of course, Mormons are capable of doing that to other people as well, of other faiths. But since I was on the receiving end of it, you know, it gave me a little martyr complex. And that only feeds your sense of heroism and feeds your sense that you're going to go somewhere and really, you know, help people despite what they might do to you.
So before you pack to go, and first there would be a sort of missionary boot camp, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but you had to get your wardrobe together, and people sort of may have a picture in their mind, or they've seen Mormon missionaries in their neighborhoods, but you had like this awesome special shirt that you thought was going to really help you stand out, even while not standing out.
Well, one of the things I mentioned is I was willing, I mean, I really wanted to go on this mission, so I was willing to do just about, you know, whatever they told me. But one thing that I had a hard time with was the plain white shirt. I mean, I knew it had to be white, but you were in the 70s, you know, bell bottoms really clothes with a flare. And I thought, there's got to be something that's better than this. And there were these shirts with white on white that, you know, they had patterns on them, maybe some grapes or, you know, some kind of leaf.
Like woven into the fabric, yeah.
Right, and you look like a tablecloth, you know, but that was the kind of thing I wanted. And so my dad, he just could not understand what this had to do, you know, why I had to have something like this. But to me, I think it was my sense that maybe this was saving me from being a clone. You know, maybe I wouldn't look quite like everybody else if I had this, but which was really a strange thing because on everything else, I was willing to go perfectly along.
And I guess the instructions were they wanted you to look like a local businessman, which may or may not have actually been true once you arrived in country.
Right. The idea was this was the guy we most specifically wanted to appeal to, I think. I mean, that was just the thinking in the 70s, and so that's who we dressed like. And so, as I say, I think our wardrobe came out of something inspired by Ward Cleaver and Leave It to Beaver, and that's who we looked like. But when we got to the country, that look was more of a 50s American look rather than a look that transcended all cultures. And so we ended up looking like the FBI, but of course, in its foreign version, it was CIA. And so little kids would often yell CIA after us and then run like crazy, hoping not to be caught by us and having to suffer the CIA kicks and punches we were sure to deliver to them, as they imagined.
So tell us about your training before you actually left for Belgium. This sounds like a really interesting time and yet a challenging time as well.
Oh, it was really challenging. But basically, you kind of get the idea of what you're supposed to do, the general outlines. It's a kind of time, you know, where you're inspired and here's what's possible for you and this is what really good missionaries do and so on. And so I ate all that up and I wanted to do that too. And then because I was learning a language, we also got 2 months of language training. And this took place in Rexburg, Idaho. In my case, that's where Dutch was being taught, which was the language I learned. And you know, it was a place that couldn't have been less like Belgium, but, you know, that's where I began to learn Dutch.
How does the language training work? Because it's fascinating to me to think of 2 months of training, and then you move to this other country where you're not only having to tell people things and communicate with them, but you're having to sort of talk about pretty complex ideas.
Well, 2 months doesn't teach you a whole lot, but it does give you a really important foundation, I think. I remember the first day I landed, we talked to some people on the street. I could not understand a thing. And here I thought I had been pretty good at it. I realized there would be a long way to go. But in the old days, say before the mid-60s, missionaries just went directly to their country and they picked up the languages they could. So I think having these institutions, these language training institutions, really helped a lot. It was also helped by the fact that in those days we memorized the lessons that we taught to people. And this was to have a certain measure of uniformity. You can't always trust 19-year-olds with what they're going to say, I think, about their church. And so we had these uniform lessons, but they also then gave you very clear sentences that you could say to people and they could understand you. The problem, of course, was once you tried to speak outside of those materials when you were first there, it wasn't easy because you were then ad-libbing.
I appreciated your candor when you talked about being in sort of language training school and you really want to be noble about everything that you're attempting to do. And yet it's hard not to be envious of the guys who picked all this up faster than you did.
I think that's an old problem with any kind of proselytizer or evangelizer going back to the ancient world, right? What kind of pride there exists in missionaries wanting to stand out, you know, wanting to be the best, wanting to convert people. Maybe it's an American thing too. And I certainly had that in me. And so I really wanted to be ahead of people in, you know, memorizing the lessons and in, you know, picking up the Dutch and being this sort of spiritual giant. So I did everything I could to do that. And I was, you know, you're sort of jealous when other people might do it a little bit better. But of course, you can't show that because that's going against all your Christian virtues, too.
My guest is Craig Harleen. He teaches European history at Brigham Young University, and he's the author of the new memoir, Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Craig Harleen, who teaches European history at Brigham Young University and is author of the new memoir, Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Greg, once you arrived in Belgium, what sort of rules governed your interactions and your sort of movement through the areas where you were going to spread your message?
Well, you get assigned to a particular city, and you have a companion that you stay with at all times. You typically live with a couple of other missionaries as well. You got up every morning at 6:30, you went to bed at 10:30, and in between you studied for a few hours, you ate a couple meals, and mostly you were proselytizing for about 10 hours a day.
The couple meals was a kind of an issue for you, because can you talk about that?
Well, most people in the West will eat three meals a day, I suppose, and to kind of show your devotion, and also sometimes because maybe the area where you were working was far away from your apartment, you would just eat one big meal in the middle of the day, like from 2 to 3:30 or something like that. And so to go outside of that was kind of to, violate the local missionary custom, I suppose. But at a certain point, I got a huge amount of courage and decided that, three meals a day really did help break up the day a little better and probably helped your blood sugar a little as well.
Put you in a better mood maybe when you're out there.
Exactly.
Okay, so what sort of training were you given about approaching people and things that might work and things that might not be such a good idea?
Well, at first, the training came from, you got a little bit in the language center, but a lot of it came from your companion, whatever missionaries you're around. This was somebody who'd been out a while, and so you kind of followed their lead, and mostly you went along the doors. This was in the 70s, right? There's no internet, no social media yet. So we went along the doors or we stopped people on the street, and you try to be as congenial as possible, try to introduce where you're from, but that was just, I think, at a time, maybe even the previous 20 years, where people started to get distrustful of people who came along the doors. In the old days of missionary, people knocked on the doors all the time. All kinds of salespeople came by, right? But by the 70s, I think you were getting more suspicious. And especially as soon as they heard our accents and saw our very non-local businessmen sorts of suits, but looked more like the CIA, I think people got really suspicious and afraid. Most of the time, you could see the look of fear in their eyes.
And it has to be hard when your heart is full of this idea and you want to share it and people not only don't trust you, but really just don't even want you to mess with them.
Oh, yeah. Well, but later on, I could understand it. I mean, all that going on a mission helped me become interested in studying religion. Then I became a professor of religious history. And what I realized was they were simply protecting what they saw as their family, their society, their values, just as anybody else might, wherever evangelizers might come through of whatever religion. So if there's a dominant religion somewhere, or even a non-dominant religion, if evangelizers come to your door, you tend to be really protective. So it was discouraging, but I didn't understand it at the time. To me, I just saw them as kind of being deceived and right, dishonest in heart and so on.
Hmm. I love the detail that the first church where you worshiped that was sort of set up from there where you were was in kind of a depressing meeting room above, of all places, a bar, which seems wrong and definitely was nothing like the nice church that you had known back home in California.
It turns out that maybe the cheapest place to rent a room on a Sunday morning is a bar. I don't know, too many people aren't there, especially the room above a bar. So we were up on the second floor, really, and that was really a shock to me because, yes, I was used to nice big chapels with a gym in the back, right? Most Mormon churches had a gym. And so, a church without a gym and a huge metal curtain to divide the chapel from the gym just didn't seem like church to me. And here we were up on the upstairs floor of a bar with maybe 10 people, attending the services. So that was a big shock.
What did you learn about the few Belgian converts that did attend with a handful of missionaries?
Well, they you had to admire them because, as I try to explain in the book, that when – and something I only realized many years later, of course, as a, when I started studying religion, was that one of the main motives that people have when they convert is social relationships. And if you live in a society where almost – in which almost everyone belongs to the same religion – if you leave that religion, you're not just changing religions as we might do here in the U.S. where there are a lot of religions to choose from, but you're leaving the entire society in a way. And so the people who have the biggest stake in that society are really not very likely to leave it. So the people who convert are going to be those at the margins of that society, or there will be those who have such an extraordinary experience in the new religion that they are willing to leave in spite of all the social costs. And so, yeah, I admired all those people. I admired, and that's exactly who was at church on Sundays. It was the marginalized in society, and especially recent immigrants, the poor, and so on. And then a few people who really were respectable in society as well, but they decided to join as well. They were probably in the minority, but still, you had to admire them.
You had to keep very detailed notes as you went and met strangers for the first time about what kinds of interactions you had with them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. We'd keep a little book as we went along the doors to keep track of where we went and what happened at that particular door. And it probably looked like we're trying to take over the world, right? When, because after we would go to a door, we would stop and write something and people would look at us really suspiciously. But mostly we were trying to avoid going back to people who had been really angry and didn't want to talk to us and especially suspicious and so on. So we're mostly trying to protect ourselves, I think, and also to remind us of people who said, you know, you can come back if you want to.
And some people were delighted to have you back. Maybe they wanted the company. Maybe they just thought you were nice boys. But typically after a point, they'd say, okay, but next time you come, let's not talk about conversion.
Oh, yeah. What I learned over time was that once people got over their suspicions, they were the friendliest people ever. Mm-hmm. It just took a while for them to get over their initial suspicions. And then at that point, they didn't want to talk about religion very much, not most of the time. And so they would say we could come by any time. They would give us food. They wanted to be friends. They wanted to ask about America. Back in the 70s, it still had this kind of exotic quality. You know, the world was a lot bigger in those days. Mm. And so I didn't always value that at first, you know, because I was there to do a job and to convert people and so on. And so I didn't value that at first.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi. Another great show as always.
Thank you.
I had a question regarding, and this is more about modern practices of Mormon missionaries, because it's interesting. All these years, I've always wanted to talk to them because I like to talk about religion, but I've never had the pleasure or opportunity to. But I've always noticed that at least the ones I've seen have always been male, and I'm curious, you may not know about common current practices, but in the past it's always been, you know, missionaries always seem to be pairs of males going around. Do females, are females allowed or even encouraged to do this, or is there any... do they do that now as opposed to back then? Or how do females fit into that picture?
Right. Women have actually been going on these missions, too, since just before 1900. And they've probably made up most of the time about 15% of the overall missionary force. And that was true in the 1970s as well. But that changed drastically in a couple of years ago, when the missionary age was lowered for young men to 18 and for young women to 19. It had previously been 19 and 21. And about half of the applicants, is from the latest things I've read, about half of the applicants now are female. So there will, you know, female missionaries will soon be as ubiquitous as males, and maybe they will have a musical made about them as well.
Where do you stand on Book of Mormon? Have you seen it? Have you heard the soundtrack?
You know, my only objection to Book of Mormon is I don't like musicals. I just never go to musicals. And I've heard it's like the biggest musical ever. You know, it's just it's a love story to musicals. So that's my problem with it. But I watched about 10 or 12 of the videos so I could talk about it, you know, 10 or 12 of the songs. And I think I have mixed feelings about it. I don't have any problem with satire. I think what's a little bit problematic is that some of the quality of the jokes being told are have the quality of things that probably should be told by insiders rather than outsiders. You know, you have your family stories and you have your family jokes. Only people in the family can tell them. Not even in-laws can tell them. You know, it's only the people in the family who can tell them. So some of the jokes have that. On the other hand, they really do humanize missionaries in some nice ways, and they get some things extraordinarily right. There's this one song called it's about you and me, but mostly me.
Right. It's funny because I thought of that song when I was reading you kind of wanting to be a star, but maybe that's because you were 19.
Well, a lot of it has to do with being, you know, late adolescent, emerging adult, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the age, and so it's symptomatic probably of all Western American males at the time. But that song, I thought, really summed up nicely what a lot of my book was trying to say, is that once I got over that, and it's, again, as I say, this is a problem. If you study the New Testament, you study the Middle Ages and evangelizing during all these periods of time, this is the problem for missionaries, you know, the sense of pride that you have from wanting to convert people, writing these heroic letters home, and feeling like, on the other hand, this humble thing that you just want to share something that you like. And so that song was amazingly right.
You know, of course, different faith traditions do this in different ways. But in the Mormon tradition, as you mentioned, the ages have been lowered to 18 for men and 19 for women. Do you think there's something special about that age? Because you do, you never have more self-confidence in some ways than you do at the end of your teenage years. And maybe that makes it easier to go, you know, walking right up to strangers and starting on a conversation that they may or may not be receptive to.
Oh, definitely. If you look at just about any society, the zealous positions in that society are often given to the young, right? Because when you're young, you are pretty sure you have the answers. Things are black and white. And you'll do things that you wouldn't have done at a later age, probably, or at least you wouldn't do them the same way. So I think that, you know, but it's also a good time in life. You usually don't have other obligations like marriage and children and things like that. And so it's probably good for a lot of reasons, you know, or at least it fits the task for a lot of reasons.
So one of the other things that you had to do was learn to get along with your housemates, your fellow missionaries. And I guess there were rules that you were all trying to follow, but, you know, an infraction here or there could either be no big deal to someone, or to someone else it would be like a very big deal.
Oh, yes. There were a series of rules, and the thinking here was that if you didn't do all the rules, then there was no way you were going to get conversions. You know, maybe if you were somewhere like Brazil, where people were seeming to run up to the missionaries to be converted, maybe you could break a few rules here and there. But no way could you do this, you know, in a place like Belgium. And so there was a real anxiety when somebody was breaking even some of the minor rules. And so there are, you know, plenty of tiffs about this. And also, it's different personalities, you know, and that would happen with any group living together. I later wrote a book about nuns living together. And you know, some of the things I saw from their personal dynamics reminded me so much of being on a mission or being a roommate at college or whatever. You know, some of these just come from living together.
And it's funny, too, because maybe with nuns and also with Mormon missionaries, people from the outside see a kind of one-dimensional picture that once you get to know people really well, you realize the variation between individuals is just as great as it would be anywhere else.
Yeah, and not only between individuals, but the things that you have in common with those people is greater than you might have thought. I mean, that's one of the big reasons I wrote the book. I didn't write it just for Mormons, although I'm sure former missionaries can relate to a lot of the things I write about, but also for people who aren't Mormon. The idea is to humanize missionaries, both for Mormons and for people who aren't Mormon, because I think Mormons tend to idealize them a little. I think outsiders are, you know, they're kind of these mysterious, maybe sinister, maybe robotic, maybe moronic, you know, thanks to the musical, moronic sorts of people. And the idea is to show that, gee, you might have a lot more in common with them than you thought. And one of the things I learned on my mission was I had a lot more in common with other people than I thought. That's people who were not Mormon.
How often were people genuinely curious about what you had to say, but not at all interested in converting?
Well, most of the time, because most of the doors we knocked on, supposedly, you know, if you knocked on doors all the time, you'd convert one out of every 1,000 people, but that did not hold true because we'd get up to 1,000 doors in about a week.
Seriously?
Yeah. And so that didn't hold true at all. But for people who actually let you in and wanted to hear some of the lessons, which happened maybe, you know, 5 to 10 times a week, You know, they might be interested initially. I think most of them were just curious that you were American and that you had bothered to learn their language. Mm-hmm. They just couldn't believe that an American could speak, you know, Dutch or the local dialect, Flemish, right? So I think that had a lot to do with their curiosity. But then there were some people who truly were interested in having religious discussions, and some of them would, you know, come close to converting, but then typically for family or social reasons, then eventually would not. Or maybe because, they just decided in the end they weren't convinced and didn't want to convert. But, you know, there's no single reason usually that people convert. We always want to attribute it to some simple thing, but usually it's this combination of things.
So when you were doing your mission, it was a big deal to have a young lady to write to, whether or not she was really a girlfriend or just someone you were kind of sweet on. Can you explain this to us?
Oh, yes. This kind of added to your legitimacy as a missionary, ironically. I mean, you couldn't date for, you know, the whole time you were out there. You weren't even supposed to have any kind of private conversation with any female while you were there. You couldn't write to any female who lived within the mission boundaries and so on. But somehow writing to one back home, yeah, that made you a more serious missionary. It's just a kind of informal cultural thing. It's never something that was said or written down. And so even if you didn't actually have a girlfriend, this would be really important too. And when you were a missionary, you could get a number of Mormon girls to write to you because at the time, you know, they had these idealized view of missionaries. And people are always better in writing than they are in person anyway, right? So far away, you look pretty good. And so there was a certain kind of ideal romanticized version of male missionaries for Mormon females back home. Now, again, this has changed a lot lately because now just as many females are applying to go, and this is going to change fundamentally, you know, how the missionary work proceeds. It will change Mormon culture, I think, in many ways as well, and there will be whole new relationships going on.
Craig Harleen is my guest. He teaches European history at BYU and is author of the new memoir, Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Craig Harleen. He teaches European history at Brigham Young University and has a new memoir out called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Craig, did anyone ever turn the tables on you when you were trying to teach them lessons about the LDS Church? Did they turn around and say, you need to hear about Roman Catholicism?
Oh, sure they did. Sometimes we would talk to priests and they would want to tell us about their religion. But often when we talked to priests, they were actually just really friendly and just wanted to chat in general. Sometimes we would meet, it was often some Americans that we would meet who would want to kind of instruct us. I remember a fellow who was... Where was he from? I think he was from Texas. Hmm. And he wanted to, you know, tell us his evangelical beliefs and so on. And it was stunning to me because I was not prepared for the, kind of the onslaught of information that he had. But anyway, yeah, so sometimes that would happen. We were not really good listeners. That's one of the things I regret. And I think they've probably gotten better at, but I think that we could probably still get better at is listening to other people and what they think about things, how important their beliefs are and what the nature of their beliefs are as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jerry on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
I just wanted to say that I I saw the Book of Mormon when I was in New York last summer, and it's a great, fun show, and it's really fun, funny satire. It's not mean-spirited, but that's not the reason I called. While I was listening, I had a remembrance of when I was a child. I was 10 or 12 years old, and we went to church one Sunday morning, and they had missionaries there speaking to the church. And when Mother said that's what we were going to do, well, I thought, oh, that'll be cool. And I thought when I got there, it was going to be kind of like a travel log, because I thought travel was a neat thing. And so they started talking, and the man talked for a while, and then his wife spoke, and she said, and when we got the call, we knew it was the exact thing that we needed to do. And she said, we just literally quit everything and went. And I thought, oh, my goodness, if you wonder, you get the call, there's nothing you can do about it. And I couldn't think of anything worse than being a missionary, and I couldn't wait for church to be out, because I decided that if I got far enough away from the building, that I would be less in jeopardy.
You would be less likely to get the call if you went away.
Exactly. And that's all I wanted to say, because he's got such a great sense of humor. I thought he might get a kick out of that.
No, that's pretty funny. Well, I would have. I didn't feel that way when I was a kid. I might feel that way now. But I didn't feel that way when I was a kid.
What kind of advice did you give your own children about preparing for their missions?
Well, I tried to maybe tell a more whole story to them. But on the other hand, you know, they're teenagers, they're young kids, and if you kind of hit them over the head with anything, any subject, you know, they're just not going to get it. And you're also maybe imposing your will a little too much. You want to let them figure some things out for themselves and come to their own conclusions. But, you know, I was glad to tell my experiences when they showed some interest. And I would try to tell different kinds to try to get them to expect that, you know, they would not just have all these perfect and wonderful experiences. And I think my daughter, I think my two sons had, you know, pretty good experiences. I think my daughter, maybe she did best because she was oldest when she left. She was 22 by the time she left, and she had a degree in religion from Seattle Pacific University. And so she was really well equipped and she went to France, so much like Belgium in its difficulty. She was really well equipped to talk to people of all kinds of religions. And she did face all kinds in France, because there were also so many immigrants from various countries. And she had a really good experience, mostly because she kind of treated it like she was this religion clearinghouse. You know, they didn't have to all become Mormon. She said some would be happier just staying Muslim. Some would be happier being this. And she kind of knew who would be happiest with which religion. And so she would talk to people who she thought would be happier as Mormons than they were at the time. But she was also content to have just a good conversation about something meaningful with people, whereas I wasn't content unless I actually converted someone. So I think we had much different experiences because of our personalities, our expectations, our maturity, our training.
Do you think that, does that represent a sea change in how the LDS Church approaches missionary work? It sounds like when you went, you were really told to, you know, I don't know, rack up the numbers, but, you know, to yeah. really, to convert some souls.
Well, from what I've talked to a lot of missionaries over the years, and I still talk to those coming home to ask how things are, and I talk to my kids, and I get the sense that, yeah, in some respects it's changed, but I think my daughter was unusual that way. I think there are others who are just as zealous as when I was a missionary, and there are some leaders who do things that way too. So I think you have a mix of approaches. I think some people are really happy just having, you know, meaningful conversations, establishing friends. And other people aren't. You know, they want big numbers of converts and things.
You had a really interesting epiphany on a snowy Christmas morning.
I did. This was when I was really struggling and trying to find some kind of meaning. And we went to deliver some presents on Christmas morning to people, a couple of widows, I think, who didn't have any family. And one of them lived way out in the countryside. We didn't even, you know, there was no Google Maps. We had a map that vaguely gave where she lived, gave us an idea where she lived. We took a train about 30 miles away. And then we thought we'd take a bus because her house was about 5 miles from that. But there was no bus. And so we had to walk. And it was getting, you know, it gets dark at 4:30 in winter in Belgium. And so we were trying to beat the dark, at least get to her house before dark. And we had to walk through these fields that were covered with snow. But it was this epiphany that I had walking through these fields, which I wasn't really excited about doing. And all of a sudden, I looked off to the side, and there was this beautiful white panorama, this kind of mist, this rolling layer of mist just above the ground, and the ground itself rolling. So the mist was irregular, and then above that, you could barely see, you know, distinguish the great white clouds. And it just really looked beautiful. And I realized that this kind of cold weather, this place where people didn't really want to listen to me, it really was a beautiful place. And I just had to accept it more for what it was. And when I did that, I was a lot more content. I still had my moments. I called it going grandiose, you know. I still would go back into my heroic mode of feeling like, oh, now I'm really going to convert lots of people. But that kind of gave me a foundation for when I had difficulties, you know, in the future months, that I would always think back on that experience just to be content and to let the country be as it was and talk to people who maybe really wanted some information instead of just trying to impose it on everyone.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Lisa in Fort Worth. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there. My question for you is, I have a good friend that did go on a mission, a female, and granted it was back in the 80s. She is lesbian, and she had a really difficult time, really struggled with the other missionaries, with her companion and things like that. I wondered if you could speak to how it is in the church today or the history of the church for people that are LGBT.
Right. In the 80s, I think it would have been really hard. I mean, in a way, being a missionary is the one time where if you are LGBT, then that might be your happiest moment as a Mormon in some ways, because everybody is supposed to be asexual on their mission, right? Mm. So nobody is anything supposedly, but of course in reality, it doesn't completely go away. I mean, that's why, right, I and many other male missionaries are eagerly writing all these females back home. But in the 80s, I think it would have been really hard because it was kind of vague in the church. Now it's become much more clear that, you know, the church has taken a position that various other churches have taken, that, you know, it's perfectly fine to be a member in good standing in the church and to be LGBT, but that you cannot act on this inclination. And so that's a clear policy. I don't think that necessarily solves the problem. And I think there will still be things to be worked out on this. And I think it would still be difficult. But I think it's also true that there are more who go on missions who are self-consciously what they are. I think in the old days, it was more of a repressed thing, and you went on a mission to try to cure yourself. You know, that was the thinking in those days. And nowadays it's more accepted that this is kind of, you know, who you are. And so there is some openness about it on missions. I'd have to talk to more modern missionaries to see how open it is. I wonder. I'm sure it varies from missionary to missionary. Like with my daughter, I'm sure, you know, she would have been fine being with people of all sorts.
How did your personal narrative, your understanding of what this experience was, how has it changed over the decades?
I think if I'd written the book 5 years after I came home, like I first wanted to, or 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, you know, it would have been a different book every time. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I wrote it some 30 to 35 years after, you know, that's what it is at that moment. But I think that's it's a view I'm pretty happy with, and that is the view that I try to portray in the book, which is that I got a lot out of it, but it's not what I expected to get out of it. And what I got out of it was what I had to dig inside and find and kind of find my own answers. And I think that's the message for anybody in just about any religious situation at some point. You know, I mean, you feel like you want to do God's will if you're a believer, but then at certain points, sometimes you feel like maybe God's will is for you to do what he created you to do. You know, you could get into that theological idea as well. So I think that's one of the main things I learned was, you have to kind of dig inside yourself and search a little more and figure out what that relationship is. And then also the main thing I think I got out was the relationships I had with the people. And one of the biggest surprises in the world to me was that I wasn't just teaching, these people in this church that I imagined was this horrible church, but I was learning from them. And that changed my whole view of the church. And again, it made me want to become a student of religion. And so I've, been studying Catholicism and Protestantism ever since. It was just that how much we can learn from each other, whatever our background or whatever our religion is. We have more in common with each other than we think.
Do you find in having studied multiple religious traditions that it's harder or easier to understand why sort of separate denominations tend to come up against so much conflict with one another, or at least have historically?
Oh, no, I think it makes it more clear how these differences happen. It does make it a little more baffling sometimes whether the conflicts are worth it. But I think you at least begin to understand where the conflicts came from and what your original roots are. I mean, when you're a missionary, you're taught to focus on the differences. And that's what people ask you all the time. What's the difference between your church and my church? And so that's what you look for. And then as a professor of religious history, you kind of begin to see almost without even trying how similar a lot of these things are and how a lot of the differences that emerged really weren't that important of differences. At least, that's my view of it. They're differences that don't make a difference. Let's put it that way. And sometimes we turn them into huge things. And people have different opinions about this. So what can you do? You have some beliefs are just so crucial to you, you can't give them up. But part of getting along with others is, you kind of have to give up some of your identity in a way if you want to reconcile with other people.
Does the missionary tradition within the Mormon Church mean that there are no Mormon helicopter parents who are still sort of hovering over their college freshman and sophomore age students?
Well, if you're gone by the time you're a freshman or sophomore, then I guess they can't hover as much. There is kind of a buffer between the parents and the missionaries. I mean, the whole infrastructure of the mission is kind of between you. So you can't hover as much. However, no one's stopping you from sending a package every day if you wanted to. And so, maybe you feel a little less removed from your parents, but you have a new one to take their place in the form of the mission president or your local leaders, right? So, maybe the parents are gone, but there might be other people.
Craig Harleen teaches European history at Brigham Young University. His new memoir is called Way Below the Angels, the pretty clearly troubled but not even close to tragic confessions of a real-life Mormon missionary. Craig, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, you're welcome. I was glad to be here.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.